Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is March 29th, 2024, and I'm your skeptical host, Dennis Wren. The title of today's podcast is Don't Stop Believing a Vaccine Can Work for RSV. Our guest skeptic is Dr. Michael Cosimini, who is a pediatrician in Portland, Oregon. He is the designer of Empiric Game, a medical editor and contributor to Pediatrics Reviews and Perspectives, or PEDSRAP, and the digital media editor at Academic Pediatrics. He's passionate about podcasting and serious games for medical education. Michael, welcome to Ask Gem Peds.
Dennis, it's great to be meeting you. I've heard your voice many times on PEDSRAP and other places in the podcasting world. It's great to see your face here on Zoom or Zencaster, as it were.
Well, Michael, I have to also thank you because I think it was during my first parental leave that I decided that I would cold message you on the platform formerly known as Twitter. And you were the one that actually connected me with Dr. Saul Bihar and the PEDSRAP group.
And now we're meeting again on, is this your second parental leave?
This is my second parental leave.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. But speaking of babies, why don't we jump into the case that we have today?
All right. We're going to your setting now, Dennis. I'm an outpatient pediatrician now, and previously I've worked as a hospitalist, but you're an emergency medicine doctor. So we're going to your domain here. A four-month-old twin girl is brought in by her parents to the emergency department for respiratory distress. She has congestion, runny nose, and cough for 3 days. Parents think the breathing has been getting worse and she's breathing faster than she would typically. On exam, tachypnea, 66 breaths a minute. You've got subcostal retractions and she's satting 86% on room air. Suck out some of those boogers, but she's still tachypneic and sats are under 90%. And your viral testing comes back with our personal favorite respiratory syncytial virus, RSV. We put her on supplemental oxygen and send her up to the hospital for observation. Parent says, hey, there's a twin at home, and we heard there's an RSV vaccine. Does that vaccine work, Dr. Wren?
This is a conversation that you probably have in the primary care clinic, but honestly, I've also had this conversation in the emergency department. But Michael, you're a big infectious disease buff as well, so why don't you tell us a little bit about this RSV that's like the bane of pediatricians' existence, I think.
Yeah, so RSV is a super important bug for those of us in pediatrics. The youngest age group is who we really think about this in, infants and toddlers. It causes bronchiolitis, which is, you know, those kids that are coughing, wheezing, tachypneic, super snotty, and breathing difficulty that can lead to either need for supplemental oxygen or support with fluids because they're not feeding well. It's really the number one reason why kids in the youngest age group are hospitalized for respiratory infections.
Now, Michael, I can't help thinking about RSV without thinking about the quote, don't just do something, stand there. Because there's so many things that we've tried for bronchiolitis that really don't seem to have much effect at all. And that includes hypertonic saline, high flow nasal cannula oxygen, corticosteroids, bronchodilators, and that's just to name a few things. But one thing that has also been tried but not covered on the SGEM is a vaccine for RSV.
The number of times that you've been covering this on your show is really a testament to how important RSV is for those of us taking care of kids, whether it's in the outpatient or the emergency room. And we have been just dying for a way to prevent RSV infections in kids. Back in the 60s, there were a huge setback. There was a formalin inactivated RSV vaccine that was given. Unfortunately, it did not work, and actually worse than not working, it led to more severe RSV infections when kids who had never had RSV got the RSV vaccine. When they got their first RSV infection, they had more severe illness than those who were not vaccinated, including a couple deaths. So there were huge setbacks because of a vaccine that did not work the way it was expected to work. And we have just been dying for something that we can do to prevent RSV because, as you and I know, there really are no treatments that work well for it in our hospitalized children.
Now, that is completely tragic, right? That is the opposite effect of what we hope a vaccine will do. And obviously, that slowed the development of an RSV vaccine for years. So over the next three decades, researchers were finding out ways to better understand the immune response to RSV infections and explore other potential vaccine targets other than an inactivated virus.
Yeah, and there's a lot of interesting things happening. I was poking around on clinicaltrials.gov. I'm kind of excited about this nasal live attenuated vaccine. But today we're not going to talk about a vaccine. We're going to be talking about a passive immunization strategy with a monoclonal antibody.
In 2022 in the European Union and the UK, and then in 2023 in the US and Canada, they approved nirsevimab, which was designed to prevent RSV. And this is a monoclonal antibody that is supposed to neutralize it by targeting a protein that is critical for the virus's ability to actually enter and infect human cells. And this new vaccine technology is kind of a shift towards monoclonal antibody therapy for RSV prevention.
And prior to this Harmony study that we're going to be discussing today, I had been offering nirsevimab based on that FDA approval and data from the Melody style, which was a previous phase 3 RCT that enrolled 1,490 kids, showed good safety compared to placebo, reduced medically attended lower respiratory tract infections with RSV, but was not, I think, probably powered to show a difference in hospitalization.
So, Michael, what is the clinical question that we are asking today?
So the question today is, does this antibody, nirsevimab, have an impact on hospitalizations for RSV-associated lower respiratory tract infections in healthy infants?
Maybe some of you are asking, why are we talking about this on SGEM? Isn't this a primary care issue and this is an emergency medicine-focused podcast? Well, you know, as Ken says, we are the light in the house of medicine. We are available all the time, handle a range of concerns, and inevitably, some of those concerns fall into the realm of primary care. But for the patients and families who may not be able to see their primary care providers for one reason or another, we are still here to care for them. And I will say that I've actually had quite a few vaccine-related conversations in the emergency department. Michael, what's the reference today?
So this is Drysdale et al., nirsevimab for prevention of hospitalizations due to RSV in infants, New England Journal of Medicine, 2023. And this is data from the Harmony trial.
Moving on to our PCOT questions. What was the population in this study?
So the population of this study is infants less than 12 months of age that were at least 29 weeks gestation at birth entering their first RSV season. So this one included premature infants.
And they did exclude infants that had a history of immunocompromise, active RSV or lower respiratory tract infection at the time that they were enrolled, if the mother had received an RSV vaccine, or if they were eligible for palivizumab. And there's actually a very long list that we'll link in the show notes. What was the intervention?
So this is a single intramuscular injection of nirsevimab, 50 versus 100 milligrams, depending on weight.
And the comparison?
The comparison here is not a placebo. It's just standard of care. So they either got the injection or they did not get anything.
What was the outcomes that they were looking at? Let's start with the primary outcome.
So the primary outcome here is hospitalization for RSV-associated lower respiratory tract infections. So they have to be admitted to the hospital and then have a test that documents RSV infection.
And what about their secondary outcomes?
So the secondary outcome is very severe RSV-associated lower respiratory tract infection. And very severe to me, I don't know, I would think like PICU and intubation, but the definition of very severe here for this study is oxygen saturation less than 90% and need for supplemental oxygen.
And they also looked at some safety outcomes as well. So rounding out our PCOT, what kind of trial was this?
So this is a phase 3B open label pragmatic randomized trial.
And the authors concluded, quote, nirsevimab protected infants against hospitalization from RSV-associated lower respiratory tract infection and against very severe RSV-associated lower respiratory tract infection in conditions that approximated real-world settings. End quote. Moving on to our quality checklist for randomized clinical trials. First question, was the study population inclusive or focused on those in the emergency department?
I don't know if they're really focused on the emergency department. These were kids recruited from 235 sites across France, Germany, and the United Kingdom, but we don't have a lot of other detail beyond that.
Were the patients adequately randomized?
Yes, I believe so.
Was the randomization process concealed?
No, they were not concealed here. So like you either got a shot or you did not, and there was no placebo. You know exactly what group you're in this study.
Were the patients analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized?
Yes. There was at least one kid that got nirsevimab that was not supposed to be, but they were analyzed as they were randomized.
Were the study patients recruited consecutively, meaning that there was no selection bias?
I found that a little bit unclear from the way this article was written. I wasn't sure about this.
Were the patients in both groups similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yeah, so table one looks pretty good here, distributing the two groups between those who got the nirsevimab and who got standard of care.
And were all the participants, the patients, clinicians, outcome assessors, unaware of the group allocation?
Once again, it's no in this case. So this is open label. People know if they got nirsevimab or not. There may be some clinicians down the road who are treating these kids during their hospitalizations who will not know, but we're not actually sure if they do or do not know who got the intervention down the road. And I think we'll get into that in a little bit more detail.
Already preempting my favorite section. All right, were all the groups treated equally except for the intervention?
As far as the study is concerned, yes, but I think it's a little bit unclear down the road if people knowing they had received nirsevimab or not would impact care from other providers down the road through the period of the study.
Do you think the follow-up was complete?
I think we have an adequate amount of kids that are captured going forward in this study, yes.
Did they consider all patient-important outcomes?
I think the most important patient-facing outcomes on this are going to be safety of the injection and the RSV-related outcomes. And I think these are well captured the way the study is conducted.
Was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
I know in our prep document, you and me have kind of gone different directions on this, but I think I would say yes to this question, but I think we'll dig into this.
Absolutely. Looking forward to that nerdy discussion coming up. And the last question, were there any financial conflicts of interest?
Absolutely. This is a study that was conducted by the companies making this medication and selling this medication. And we have a number of authors that were either employees of the companies or, and even the first draft was written by a hired medical writer by one of the companies. So certainly financial conflict of interest is potential here.
Moving on to the results. So they recruited a little bit over 8,000 infants from across those 235 sites. 4,037 received nirsevimab and 4,021 had that standard of care, which means they got nothing. Slightly over 20% of the group were neonates and about 14% were less than 37 weeks gestational age. Michael, can you give us the key result?
The key result is a positive primary outcome, which is nirsevimab reduced hospitalizations for RSV-associated lower respiratory tract infection in these kids.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more detail now. In terms of that primary outcome, what do they find?
So for the primary outcome, we have 0.3%. So 11 infants in the nirsevimab group were hospitalized compared to 60 infants, 1.5% in the standard of care group. So they calculate out an efficacy of 83% for preventing hospitalization for this primary outcome.
When it came to their secondary outcomes of very severe RSV-associated lower respiratory tract infection, there was a 0.1% admission rate in the nirsevimab group and a 0.5% in the standard of care group. And that corresponded to an efficacy of around 76%.
Yeah, and I think the raw numbers help a little bit with that quote-unquote very severe RSV-associated lower respiratory tract infections. We have 5 in the nirsevimab group compared to 19 in the control group. But only 2 kids in the nirsevimab end up in the ICU compared to 5 in the control group. And only 1 kid gets intubated and put on a vent in this entire study. They did happen to be in the control group.
Let's talk a little bit about the adverse events because those are important. We don't want to hurt these kids in the process. What do they find, Michael?
Overall, very similar rates of adverse events in both the nirsevimab group and the standard care group.
Yeah, there were slightly more medically attended events, and those were defined as instances that prompted the infant's caregivers to seek unplanned in-person medical advice in any setting, and that was 29.5% in the nirsevimab group compared to 27.4% in the standard care group. All right, Michael, are you ready for my favorite section? Are you ready to talk nerdy?
Oh, yes, let's do this.
Nerdy point number one is the industry involvement. Now, before we jump into the other points, I think we mentioned this before, but it's important to recognize the level of involvement from the pharmaceutical company who sponsored the trial. They had input in the trial design. They performed the data analysis in collaboration with the authors. They funded a medical writer to write that first draft of the manuscript that was then edited by the authors. Now, this does not necessarily mean the results are untrustworthy, but it does raise my skeptical antenna, because many industry-sponsored studies tend to report results that are favorable to the sponsor. We do have a graphic in the show notes here with all of the authors that highlight those with conflicts of interest and who are employees of the pharmaceutical company. And I also think the efficacy numbers presented look very impressive as well, but the absolute numbers are actually very small. And when we look at the primary outcome, there's a difference of 1.2% between the groups, which is the number needed to treat of 83. And the secondary outcome had a difference of 0.4%, which is a number needed to treat of 250.
Yeah, I just like, this is a classic thing that people do in papers, right? The absolute and the relative risk reduction are going to look different, especially with something rare like this. And thankfully, the very severe outcomes are relatively rare in RSV. But then again, number needed to treat of 83, I love it. I still take it.
Michael, do you want to go on and talk to us about nerdy point number two?
Okay, so this is tricky, and it's one of these things where we're not going to have perfect information to deal with. It's an unmasked trial, so parents know if their child got nirsevimab or not. This could influence parents' reasons for seeking care in one way or another. This is something that the parents can communicate to providers that see them in the future. We don't know if they do or do not do that. And it's a little bit hard to know how outcomes will be impacted by the fact that people know what groups they're in. I think to some degree, this is mitigated by using hospitalization as an outcome, in contrast to MELODY, which we mentioned earlier on, which was a study that showed, you know, about 80% reduction in medically attended RSV infections. I think by making the outcome hospital admission, that mitigates this to some extent.
Now, Michael, I'm going to offer a counterpoint on this, in that their primary outcome for hospitalization for RSV-associated lower respiratory tract infection, right? We added that qualifier, RSV-associated, and that allows a degree of subjectivity and a potential bias as well. And it seems like they used RSV testing to determine whether or not hospitalization was RSV-associated, but that's also imperfect. And what if the child was hospitalized as a side effect of the intervention? When they report the adverse events, it's not that clear if any of them actually resulted in hospitalization.
Yeah, we don't know the overall rates of hospitalization in these two groups. We do know that hospitalization for lower respiratory tract infections was impacted by the intervention. So hospitalization during RSV season happened in 1.1% of the infants in the nirsevimab group, compared to 2.4% in the standard of care group. So that calculates out to a 58% efficacy of the nirsevimab in preventing any lower respiratory tract hospitalization in this study.
Nerdy point number three is about the RSV test itself. Now, I had made a comment earlier that RSV testing was imperfect. So tell us what they used here to determine whether or not this was RSV associated.
Yeah, so in this time period in the UK, France, and Germany, the authors say that they're doing PCR testing for all kids who are admitted to the hospital with lower respiratory tract infection. So these kids should be getting that test while they're hospitalized as routine practice. And that's how they're detecting the kids that meet the primary outcome.
And the families also had these cards to give the treating clinicians as well to encourage testing for RSV. But is PCR testing for RSV really a gold standard? Now, there is some research suggesting that test positivity can linger for as long as 30 days. So I don't know what proportion of these children had maybe multiple viruses detected. Maybe they had RSV along with that, but it wasn't really contributing to their disease process, or they were just found to incidentally be RSV positive. It's truly unclear. And as a reminder, the most recent Choosing Wisely campaign from the American Academy of Pediatrics included the statement, "Do not obtain comprehensive viral panel testing for patients who have suspected respiratory viral illnesses." Oh my gosh, I really do not like respiratory viral PCRs.
Yeah, I'm with you. Especially in the outpatient setting, I feel like there's not really much of a role for them where I practice. Viral testing is hard to use practically in a meaningful way that will help our patients.
We're definitely in agreement there. Nerdy point number four is about the decision for admission. decision to hospitalize a child was up to the discretion of the treating physician, which is appropriate. The authors report that this was rarely an investigator who took part in the study, but they do not know how many caretakers may have told the treating physician that their child was enrolled in the study. And while the paper does make the claim that, quote, "we believe risk of bias was low with respect to the primary endpoint analysis," I don't know if I'm fully convinced, because I do think this may have influenced the decision for admission.
I think this is extremely difficult. And I think knowing which kids get admitted for lower respiratory tract infection is very setting specific, and neither of us practice in these countries. So I think it's really hard. And I think it's an important consideration. I was digging through the documents. They use this guideline on the clinical evaluation of medicinal products indicated for the prophylaxis or treatment of respiratory syncytial virus disease, these European Medicine Agency's guidelines for designing these studies. And in there, they say, don't use hospitalization as a metric of severity because there is variable practice on hospitalization. The other challenge is, like, they say that the people at the time of admission did not have the testing results, which feels very strange to me because I'm, like, so accustomed to those PCRs coming back quickly. And I don't know about you, Dennis, but, like, if you have a patient, like a bronchiolitic who's RSV negative and a bronchiolitic that's RSV positive, does that impact your decision making of hospitalization? I feel like humans might be impacted by that information if they got it.
Oh, yeah, I definitely feel like that would play a role in my decision making process. And again, like you mentioned, it's subjective, right? There's a treating physician's tolerance level that needs to be considered here. And maybe I might be a little bit more tolerant of a degree of work of breathing in comparison to yourself or other people. And there's obviously the risk of apnea with RSV versus not RSV. Maybe there's also a question of, can they get reliable, close follow-up if I send them home from the emergency department? So there's a lot of factors that actually play into the decision for admission. It's not an objective measurement. And our last nerdy point is about RSV seasonality and effect size. So Michael, I have to say, anecdotally, I'm waiting for the data to come out, but I feel like this season was a little bit better compared to the year we had the triple-demic. How do you think that impacts your interpretation of this study?
It's really feeling like a milder year this year, and I'm absolutely appreciating that. And I think maybe some of that is the nirsevimab that we've been slamming in the nursery. But I think it's an important caveat to this article is this study was done on a very difficult RSV season and a very active RSV season. And with, you know, a heavy burden of disease, the number needed to treat was 83. That number may go up in future seasons if it's not as bad of an RSV season.
And if we look at figure two as well, it seems like there's overall fewer infants that were older in that greater than 3 to 6 months or greater than 6 month category who were hospitalized, which made that 95% confidence interval much wider, crossing zero.
Yeah. And I think that makes sense to me, right? Like the 2 to 4 months is sort of like the peak age where kids have a rough time with RSV. So the older a kid is when you give them this immunization, or the older they are when they hit RSV season, the less likely there's going to be impact compared to the youngest group and the people that are the littlest when they're getting hit by this. There is a relatively recent MMWR report giving an estimate of 90% efficacy at preventing hospitalizations, but there's some caveats on that.
Yeah, that study only had a very small portion of hospitalized infants who received nirsevimab and was a case control design. So we'll link that report in the show notes, but I don't know if I have it in me to do another critical appraisal in the same episode, Michael.
No, absolutely.
Can you comment on the author's conclusion compared to the SJM conclusion?
We agree with the author's conclusion. You know, be wary of industry role in this trial and which ones are being published and which ones aren't.
And give us the SJM bottom line.
Nirsevimab may reduce RSV-associated hospitalizations in infants.
That case that we presented in the beginning, that family in the emergency department, what are you going to tell them?
So I'm going to say there's a new medicine called nirsevimab. It's a single injection. It's approved for infants if they're less than 8 months of age in the U.S. to be given before or during RSV season. And it's looking very safe from a side effect profile, and it may prevent both RSV-associated presentations to care, as we saw in the MELODY study. And here it's looking to prevent hospitalizations in the HARMONY study. So certainly something I'm encouraging them to get for their twin control child.
we all have intervention children and control children, huh? Is that how things go now?
well, the one's got RSV and the other one we don't know yet. So
fair enough. All right, Michael, let's talk about the clinical application now. I think you've said this a couple of times, but it sounds like you have already been giving nirsevimab. Is that correct?
Yeah, it came out this season. I was walking around with the printout of the MELODY study in my pocket because where I work, there's a lot of healthcare professionals delivering their babies. So I would, you know, go over that article with them and encourage the immunization for that. We've got a bigger sample here showing safety, which is nice, and a very similar rate of prevention of hospitalization to the rate of prevention of presentation to care in the previous study. So I think continues to support its use. And those of us in pediatrics that really hate RSV are happy to have a tool in our toolkit to prevent it.
Now, I'm impressed that you've been actually able to give it, because I've had a lot of issues hunting it down for my own family in this area, despite such publicity from the pharma company and fanfare from the American Academy of Pediatrics and the CDC. I just feel like the rollout has been rather lackluster. So I know I'm not alone in this when I talk to my patients in the emergency department. Michael, what are you going to tell the patient?
There's a medicine called nirsevimab, and there's some research suggesting now it's protecting against hospitalization with respiratory syncytial virus.
Well, Michael, thanks for having this discussion with me. I think we had some really nice back and forth bringing up various perspectives and viewpoints and limitations. And I do want to put a disclaimer here in that I don't think either of us as pediatricians are doing this episode out of wanting to promote vaccine hesitancy or, you know, are telling people not to vaccinate their kids, because I personally feel that there are many benefits to vaccination. But I do want to emphasize the point that even though we see a study in which conclusion we really want to agree with, right, we are still applying that same critical lens and the same structured critical appraisal tool to that study to make sure that we are not just perpetuating a confirmation bias.
Hey, Dennis, this was great. Thanks for having me on here.
And before we go, do you mind giving us the SGEM tagline?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.